weather's not always raining. There'll be days like this when there's no one complaining. There'll be days like this. Everything falls into place like the flick of a switch. Well, my mama told me there'll be days like this.
All right, here we go. It is 3:07 on the Central Coast, and it is Tuesday. Can you believe it? September 1st. Where is this year going? September 1st, 2020. I'm Dave Congleton. This is Hometown Radio. Good to be with you. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for supporting live local Hometown Radio. We are here all the way until 7 o'clock on this broadcast day. Straight ahead. During the 4 o'clock hour, let's talk about public attitude towards police today. When you hear the word police, what comes to mind? I want to talk about that. Today, by the way, we crossed the 3,000 mark of COVID-19 cases in this county. But yet, Cal Poly is going to open up next week to anywhere between 4,000 to 5,000 students, even though many universities across the country have decided not to do that. David Holmes and Andy Greensfelder will weigh in on Cal Poly's decision. We'll give you a chance to talk about it as well. And then teacher Myla LaBarre, at 6:05, ethnic studies is back in the news. It looks like ethnic studies is now going to be required for all high school students in the state of California, following up on a similar requirement that's already gone into law for university students in California. Myla will explain what that means. It is the Dave Congleton Show. Always your hometown radio talk show. First up, Henry H.A. Ramos is with us from Studios on the Park in Paso Robles. There is a timely exhibit that's just opened today, runs throughout September. It is called Counter Narrative, an examination of recently discovered Chicano photography from 1980 through the present. Henry A.J. Ramos joins us now. Henry, good afternoon.
Hey, Dave. Good to be with you again. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, good to hear your voice, my friend. And let's start with the basics and remind folks about Studios on the Park, please.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, Studios on the Park, just a jewel in our county and region. Right there on the park, downtown Paso Robles on Pine Street. Can't miss it. And, you know, we've been around about 10, 12 years now, really serving the community, our local youth, and in partnerships with the schools. We've had community programs in partnership with the Y and Boys and Girls Clubs, the police force, you name it. We are all things to that community, and we've provided a space for our artists, our most talented presenters of visual arts, to showcase their works and their many talents. We have in-residence artists that produce work on site that people can come in and actually watch in formation. The creative process is fascinating to see unfold. We have periodic exhibits, usually monthly or every other month. We'll produce something that is of some not only artistic and creative value, Dave, but also that is inclined to educate and inform people about California history, current issues in the news. And we've just completed a first month of a great show I want to plug before we get into our main conversation, if I may. It's looking at sculpture and pottery. We haven't done a lot of that work over the years, but we have a terrific show called The Shape of Human Expression, Sculpture and Pottery, the best that the Central Coast has to offer, curated by Tom Peck, one of our founding artists, and featuring some really great producers, Burl Reichenberg, Peter Charles, Heather Cruz, and Eric Olson. And if you just pass by the window pane and peek in, you'll want to go in, because it's a compelling show and really emblematic of just the broad range of beautiful and thought-provoking works that we offer the broader community. Everything, so we welcome families and anyone that's interested in the creative process.
Everything you need to know is on the website at studiosonthepark.org. Meanwhile, though, Henry, how are you dealing with COVID still? Are people... You talked about the exhibits in the window, but are people actually allowed to come in?
Yes, and thanks for asking that. Yeah, we are actually back in business after being closed for nearly 4 months, like most businesses at the outset of this crisis. But we are exercising a lot of care. We're trying to control the numbers of people that we have circulating on the premises at any given time. We do require social distancing and face masks to be worn if you're going to come in. We want you to come in, but we want you to be safe. And, you know, the downtown has kind of recreated itself, you know, in a really, really exciting and robust way. We've got outdoor dining now on our sidewalks, a lot more activity picking up in recent weeks. So we're really excited to welcome back people that want to come and visit us. If you have a large group, probably a good idea to call us in advance, but I would say for the most part, you can kind of just, as long as you track with the social distancing and the mask, you're welcome to come and take a look at the magic we have to offer.
Henry A.J. Ramos, our opening guest on Hometown Radio. The new exhibit is called Counter Narrative, an examination of recently discovered Chicano photography from 1980 to the present. The word that jumps out at me, Henry, is Chicano. Is it mean, or is that a word we don't hear much anymore? Because I hear Hispanic, I hear Latinx, I don't hear Chicano anymore.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting and apt observation, Dave. The word Chicano really is a throwback, if you will, to the late 1960s when many younger Mexican-American working-class kids were coming up, kind of watching the African-American civil rights struggles and realizing that, you know, they too were facing a lot of issues in their schools, in the employment arena, and culture generally. They would go to movies and not see themselves portrayed either on the big screen or in television. And, you know, a lot of their fathers had gone off to fight in World War II, and many of them come back as war heroes and had really fought for democracy and, you know, against notions of kind of racial exclusion in Germany and places like Japan. And they were noting, like a lot of the youth at that time, a lot of the paradoxes or contradictions of American culture. And feeling kind of overlooked and forgotten, they decided to kind of try to reclaim a sense of ethnic identity by adopting the name Chicano, which was a somewhat militant statement of their identity. And many organizations were formed to kind of fight for Chicano civil rights at that time in the schools. There were major actions in the, for example, the East Los Angeles high schools were renowned in 1968 for a major walkout that involved 20,000 students in protest over really substandard schooling, limited college access options for those kids, kind of heavy-handed disciplinary policies. And it invoked, I think, not unlike a lot of the kind of self-determination experiences of African Americans, Native Americans, Asian Americans, and other groups, a sense that there was a need to kind of claim a sense of ethnic pride, and the term Chicano came to embody that. Now, in subsequent times, I think there's been an evolution in the political aspirations of the what is now largely called the Latino or Latinx population. And that was informed by a sense that while you had a significant number of Mexican Americans, many of whom identified as Chicanos, there were also other really important pockets of Latino or Latinx experience in New York, for example, on the other side of the country. That population of Spanish-speaking people was predominantly Puerto Rican. If you think to West Side Story, that you know, is kind of the iconic telling of that reality. Down in Miami, after the exodus of Cubans from Castro's Cuba, you had a lot of Cuban Americans. And the notion was that in order to kind of gain political footholds in the civic culture of the United States, there needed to be a broader national movement of Spanish-speaking people to come together around more common rather than ethnocentric vernacular. And so the word Latin American or Latino began to take hold. Now Latinx, because that has a sort of connotation of recognizing gender diversity in the fact that we've evolved in a lot of our thinking along those lines. So it is a little confusing, admittedly, to kind of keep up with all the changes and the evolutions and the usages, but all of those nomenclatures have their time and their place and their reasons.
All right, we are in conversation with Henry A.J. Ramos, joining us from studios on the Park up in Paso Robles. The brand new exhibit is called Counter Narrative, an examination of recently discovered Chicano photography from 1980 to the present. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about the exhibit, and then we'll talk a little bit about Chicano history, particularly in Southern California in the 1960s and 70s. I invite you to stick around. I'm Dave Congleton. You're listening to AM 920, FM 96.5, News Talk, KVEC. You have have landed on the Dave Congleton Show, always your hometown radio talk show. California Headline News and ABC Radio News await us at the bottom of the hour. We are back with Henry A.J. Ramos from Studios on the Park up in Paso Robles. The exhibit that opens today is a counter-narrative, an examination of recently discovered Chicano photography from 1980 to the present. Everything you need to know is on the website at studiosonthepark.org. Henry, as we're back with you, let's talk about the exhibit. What's in it? How did it come together?
Well, thanks for asking, Dave. This is really an examination of photography that has, you know, been in play in Southern California here and there for the last 30, 40 years, but that really in the public domain or in the academy or museums really hasn't become widely known. But it's rooted in a creative movement called OSCO, which was a art collective founded by four very iconic Latinx or Mexican-American artists, young people in their late teens, early 20s, back in the early 1970s. And this was people like Bronk, Harry Gamboa Jr., Willie Jaron, and the famous painter Patsy Valdez. They became really important in sort of developing a new narrative around Hispanic identity in that time, really kind of going in a different direction even than the more kind of militant youth efforts that were in play by groups like the Brown Berets and Chicanos por la Raza and other groups. These folks kind of took on a creative cultural identity that was distinct not only from white, you know, American mainstream culture, but also from the kind of Chicano militancy of the time. Although they themselves were progressives, they were very interested less in politics as such and much more in the creative process. They were multiplicitous in their use of the arts. They were painters. They did mural art. They did a lot of theater and performance work. They were very heavy into fashion and film. And one of the things that was particularly central to their documentation of the journey was photography. And Harry Gamboa Jr. is a widely known, world-renowned photographer coming out of that era. But what they did, and what's important for our show, is that as they evolved into the late 1970s, early 1980s, they expanded their group and took on about a dozen other people who became fairly well-known in their own right, their creative point of view. And three of the people that are part of that second group of creators called OSCO B are featured in this show, Studios on the Park. They are Sean Carrillo, who is a New York-based original member of that group, a photographer and fashion designer. Interestingly, some of your viewers, or your listeners rather, might be interested to know that his wife, Bibi Hansen, is the mother of musical artist Beck Hansen, who's pretty popular and probably known in most circles. The second person featuring is a woman named Marisela Norte, who is a principal at the LA Craft Contemporary Museum and a writer of record in the Latinx community and unofficially referred to by many people in the know as the kind of unofficial poet laureate of East Los Angeles. She's a profoundly talented poet and writer. And then the third person of interest here is Daniel Villarreal. And Daniel is a person whose work is featured at UC Santa Barbara and their archival collections of kind of notable photography. But he's mostly known to people for his film and television work. He was one of the stars of the 1989 Warner Brothers film Stand and Deliver with Edward James Olmos, and a frequent television actor on shows like Miami Vice and other kind of criminal, you know, theme shows, 1980s and 1990s. So all of these people, when they were young folks, were taking photography, they were chronicling what was happening in and around the community, and they've remained active as photographers over recent years. And so what we've put together, Dave, is a really interesting retrospective of 30 of some of their best works, dating from 1980 to the present, and kind of chronicling a lot of their journey, some of the iconic figures that they were a part of.
Were you familiar with their work in terms of these specific photographs before this exhibit, Henry?
Partly, but not fully. So for me, it was also a learning journey.
Yeah. So were you surprised by what came in, what you saw?
Yes.
Was it what you were expecting?
Yes. Well, it was not what I was expecting, but it was better than what I was expecting. And this is sort of something that I think the audience might be interested in. You know, when we think about the Chicano experience and we think about, you know, what it might look like in a photographic display, a lot of the first instincts start to go to kind of, you know, homeboy, kind of gang member, tattoo art, you know, all of which is, you know, in its own right, pretty phenomenal to examine. Nothing wrong with that genre, but that's mostly what we know. What these people were into, again, just in line with their alternative thinking and lifestyle, was they were kind of part of the punk rock scene in East Los Angeles, and then eventually they migrated into places like West LA on Sunset Boulevard at the Whiskey and other clubs that were kind of renowned, and in Hollywood at the Palladium. So they were kind of around punk rock groups that were kind of informed by the Latinx experience, groups like the Brat, the Plugs, the Illegals, and they played with folks like Joan Jett and other kind of name bands back in the day that were kind of breaking their teeth on punk rock music. So ironically, a lot of the show, not exclusively, but a lot of the show kind of tracks with that history. And I'll just say what's interesting about that is that I myself was educated and informed in new and different ways, much to my delight, to be kind of reminded that there's a very deep and rich history of contributions of Chicano or Mexican-American artists to the whole kind of modern rock experience. You can go back to Ritchie Valens, the original performer who sung the widely known song La Bamba. You know, he was from Pacoima in East L.A. Cannibal and the Headhunters, their, you know, song Land of a Thousand Dances was a big hit in the early 60s. They even opened for the Beatles at one point in 1965. You have had bands like Los Lobos, which are probably known pretty widely to most of your listeners, that came out of East L.A.
Right.
And so this show kind of embodies a lot of the unknown aspects of that history, and I think it's really edifying.
Is it evocative of a time and place, Henry?
I think it is. You know, if you kind of think back to what was happening in the 1980s, and especially for this kind of group of presenters, a lot of people were trying to break out of the box of convention, you know, and it was a little different than what was happening in the 1960s when, you know, the counterculture kind of got its legs. This was kind of a very experimental period and a very exciting period because what it invoked was a sense of possibilities for ethnically rooted Americans like Chicanos to both employ and reflect elements of the mainstream culture, but at the same time to bring their own spin to it and their own nuance. And I think that it's kind of an interesting study in fusion. And if anyone in your audience is a fan of music, culture, fashion, you don't have to be Chicano or Latinx to really appreciate, understand the power of this show. It will excite you and uplift you and, I think, move you in ways that might be surprising.
All right, we are moving to the news and traffic and weather, and we have more of our conversation straight ahead with Henry A.J. Ramos from Studios on the Park up in Paso Robles, our first guest on today's edition of Hometown Radio. More to come. Stay with us. Glad to have you with us on Hometown Radio. Thanks for tuning in. Hope you'll stick around. We're going to talk about public attitudes towards police during the 4 o'clock hour. Chris Aaron is going to be with us tomorrow. Thursday, well, we'll just see what happens, shall we? We are in conversation with Henry A.J. Ramos from the Studios on the Park up in Paso Robles. The website is studiosonthepark.org. Special exhibit, Counter Narrative, an examination of recently discovered Chicano photography from 1980 to the present, which begs the question, Henry, as we're back with you, why is it counter-narrative?
Well, I think you can interpret that in a number of ways, but basically it is sort of an effort to challenge the idea that when you think about the term Chicano or Latino, all you think about is, you know, gang members and homeboys and, you know, sort of tattoos and you know, things that in a lot of our popular culture we've come to be associated with.
Yeah.
There is that element, unquestionably, but there is so much more. And right. I think what the counter-narrative vernacular speaks to is that so much more. You know, we were into punk rock, and we were kind of breaking out in the arts in new and different ways. And I would argue, you know, that the group that I mentioned that's kind of the formative inspiration for the show, this Osco group, was really kind of like, for Chicano people, that was like our Bauhaus movement. That was our pop art movement. Those were our Andy Warhols and our Basquias. You know, these are people that in our community are reflective of those very same instincts to kind of challenge convention, challenge authority, and not just from a political standpoint, but much more powerfully from a cultural and self-identity standpoint.
Right, so as I recall, you grew up in Los Angeles, right?
I did, yeah, right in the middle of a lot of stuff that was happening in the late 60s. My father owned a store on Alvera Street downtown, and I saw the whole movie unfold.
Yeah. So what was that like for you growing up? And, I mean, you have so many dimensions to your life. Certainly artistic is one of them. What was it like for you growing up in L.A. and finding your identity?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. It was a crazy and confusing and very fluid time. My dad was extremely conservative. You know, he was one of the founding members of the Republican National Hispanic Assembly. He was a very strong ally of Ronald Reagan and many other conservative politicians in the day. He was a business owner on Alvera Street, which is really kind of the incipient street that's kind of formed the larger city of Los Angeles with a heavy Mexican-American identity. And, you know, I grew up in a time when, frankly, in our generation, most of us didn't relate to that more conservative iconography. We were watching the war in Vietnam. We were experiencing the cultural and sexual revolution of the 60s and the 70s. And, you know, frankly, there were a lot of intergenerational conflicts. My dad and I had many, many, you know, come to Jesus conversations where we just had to agree to love each other and disagree. But I think that it was a really rich time and a time that, you know, was fraught with violence and a lot of political consternation. You know, it was a time I remember being on Alvera Street and watching Robert Kennedy and Cesar Chavez give a speech at the Placita there, probably, I would say, no more than 10 or 12 days before Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. A couple of Brown Berets who were the militant analog to the Black Panthers came over during that event, and right in front of my father's store, they burned the American flag, which just inflamed my father. I mean, he went out there and started throwing punches at these guys, you know, which, you know, I don't blame him, you know. It was a really kind of just an audacious act.
Yeah.
But that was the nature of the times. And, you know, when you look at what's happening today on the streets of America, you know, it takes me back, frankly, to those incipient early memories.
All right. A couple things I want to ask you about. First, the Chicano moratorium of 1970.
Mm-hmm.
Explain that to us, please.
Well, you know, much in line with what I just talked about, many of the young Chicano Mexican-American youth of that day were very concerned about what was happening in the Vietnam War. It wasn't just a philosophical concern that they had because they didn't like the war, though there was some that, you know, just ideologically were against our involvement in Southeast Asia. But when they looked at the numbers, what was happening is that, like, the Chicano kids in the main communities that comprise the Mexican American population were about 10% of the population. And, they were like about 20% of the casualties. You know, body bags were coming back from Vietnam and they were like disproportionately and overwhelmingly, brown people. And so because there was a draft and because there seemed to be, at least in their mentality, a kind of a targeting or a kind of an over-representation of our folks kind of going to do battle and coming back, you know, not alive, there was a sense that, you know, we really just didn't want to participate in that, particularly since a lot of youth, not just Chicano youth, were really questioning what was our purpose in Vietnam? What were we doing there? It was not a unique question that only Latino people were asking. Others across the country were asking those same questions. So the Chicano moratorium was a very organized, unified effort by anti-war resistors in the Chicano community to stage a peaceful march in East Los Angeles at Laguna Park. And that march was organized, and it took shape on August 29th, 1970, almost exactly 50 years ago. And it attracted 30,000 participants, and it wasn't all, you know, lefty rabble-rousers. There were many families, women, children. It was largely a pan-community event. And unfortunately, it turned into a major race riot. What happened was there were allegedly reports of a liquor store robbery in the neighborhood across from Laguna Park that drew some L.A. County Sheriff's officers. And within an hour of that, hundreds of L.A. sheriffs were in Laguna Park, basically tear gassing and beating violently the assembled peaceful protesters that were there to express their disagreement with the war. And it became a real pivotal turning point. And one of the most sad outcomes of that event, Dave, is that the premier leader in Southern California among people looking for a voice in the Mexican-American community was a journalist named Ruben Salazar. He was a Los Angeles Times correspondent, one of the, really, I think at that time, the only Latino on the staff of the Los Angeles Times. He was the Mexico City correspondent, and he was an on-air personality on the Spanish radio station KMEX, which is the principal Spanish-speaking language station in L.A. And he was covering the events and had, at one point when the violence kind of started to kind of get out of hand, he had dipped into a nearby bar called the Silver Dollar. And unfortunately, what happened by witness account is that the L.A. sheriffs fired a tear gas canister into that bar with no warning and, just ill-advisedly, I think maybe in a panic because of the unrest that was happening. And it killed this gentleman. It killed him. It hit him right in the head. And, his voice was lost forever. So the whole Chicano moratorium is really a pivotal inflection point, a flashpoint for Chicano identity, and something that people who understand that history go back to as kind of a turning point in our political organizing history. After that, I think people spent less time marching in the streets and much more time focusing on actually getting engaged in more formal political representation, and that's where in the 1970s we began to kind of actually get people elected to, major offices on the L.A. City Council and the L.A. Board of Supervisors and another elected offices.
It isn't true, though. Laguna Park was also, the name was changed to Salazar Park in his honor.
Correct, in memory of Ruben Salazar, precisely.
All right. Well, and the other thing in the article that you sent me, it made it clear that not only was it an important moment politically, but I wrote down this phrase, it was a transformational moment for art. Because what happened is that you in Los Angeles, you would see more murals, more celebration
Correct.
Of Day of the Dead. All right.
Correct.
So talk about that, yep. Henry. It impacted art as well.
Yeah, you're right. I think the combination of the East Los Angeles school walkouts that I talked about in the first segment that happened in March of 1968, and then this event at the Chicano Moratorium 2.5 years later, kind of really, frankly, kind of both burned people out because it became very violent, very scary, but also gave life to this whole new genre of creative and cultural expression. And we saw muralists like Judy Baca who emerged to create marvelous public murals. We saw Chicano theater groups form to take their place on the stage of, performance arts. And we saw, photographers like the ones featured on our show at Studios on the Park and many of the alternative rock bands that they were kind of aligning with and recording as they went kind of come to full fruition. And, fashion and style had its place in that movement. It was just a really robust period of creativity and one that now in retrospect we applaud and honor because only now I think are we beginning to appreciate just the depth, the richness, and the power of that work.
Is there a memorial anywhere that commemorates Chicano Moratorium?
There are memorials. Yeah, there are memorials, and I think, in fact, at Salazar Park, I believe that there is a major marker of the events of that August 29th. It is something that is kind of easy to forget because, sadly, and this is another issue, we may not have time for it, but, frankly, most people coming up, even in Mexican-American or broader Latinx contexts, are really not terribly informed about our history. It's not widely taught in our schools what, were the informing, reasons why these events took shape, what happened, what did it mean. So a lot of, I think, effort has been made in more recent years by Chicano studies scholars and even more mainstream scholars to kind of make sure that the public record reflects this. And that's why it's very important that the Los Angeles Times, a very significant publication in the journalism field around the world, took the time in a series of articles over the last week to really commemorate and reflect on the lessons of those experiences.
Well, let me jump ahead, because at 6 o'clock we're going to talk about ethnic studies. Looks mm-hmm. like it's going to be required in high school. It's already going to be required in Cal State University, some kind of ethnic studies class. How do you react to that, Henry?
Well, you know, I can appreciate why some people might kind of feel like, well, why are we doing that? You know, shouldn't we just be kind of one culture, one thing? But, you know, the honest truth is that America has always been a very diverse mosaic of different influences and different cultures. And I do think that it's, especially as our demographic shifts to a more minority-dominant reality, I think it's a very important thing to examine how we have faced challenges in terms of racial conflicts and how we have, in our time and in our way, overcome them. Because we are in a moment right now where we can use some of those lessons. It should be obvious to anybody looking at the news today that we have a lot of misunderstandings across lines of race and ethnicity. Our history as a country is mostly quite glorious. I think it's something that most of us would be proud of, to be a part of the democracy that we've evolved into over the past 250-plus years. But let's be honest, we have a very tortured history when it comes to the Native American population, to the Latino populations across the Southwest. If you look at the way that Chinese were treated, or the Japanese Americans during different parts of our history, with the internment during World War II and, you know, anti-immigration laws that were targeted to Chinese people getting back to 1880, you can go on and on. There's a lot of reasons why inequality has been embedded in our system. And I think the only way that we can kind of find peace and common cause, and the only way we can evolve and move forward as a society, is if we have a much deeper and better understanding of, you know, how these realities played out, why they played out, and how we can hopefully do better going forward as a more multicultural and more unified society.
Our guest is Henry A.J. Ramos from Studios on the Park up in Paso Robles. Big exhibit runs throughout September. We'll come back for a final segment. You're listening to the Dave Congleton Show on AM 920, FM 96.5, News Talk, KVEC. The exhibit opened today up in Paso Robles at Studios of the Park. It's called Counter Narrative, an examination of recently discovered Chicano photography from 1980 through the present. It runs throughout the month of September. Everything you need to know is on the website at studiosonthepark.org. Henry A.J. Ramos is talking a little bit about the exhibit and the history that inspired it. I have got to ask you, Henry, in this final segment, to talk about Catalina Island, because mm-hmm. until I read this story a couple weeks ago, I had no idea. And early in the last segment, you mentioned, was it the Brown Berets?
Correct.
Right.
Yeah.
They actually tried to take over Catalina Island?
They did. It's an interesting story. Want me to talk about it?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, well, the Brown Berets were a kind of a paramilitary organization, a militant left Chicano power organization that, again, was a response to a lot of the oppression that many Chicano people felt in the times, owing to police misconduct and, you know, school underfunding and lack of opportunities and the economy. And, you know, they, I think, were frankly a fringe organization, I wouldn't say, but they were certainly not representative of the main flow of where most Mexican-American or Chicano people were. Most Mexican-American Chicano people were, frankly, quite conservative or, you know, interested in kind of working within the system to make the changes that they felt were needed to be made. But the Brown Berets, not unlike the Black Panthers in the African-American community or comparable groups in the Native American population, were activists like at the far end of the spectrum. And on August 30th, 1972, they assembled, it's probably not lost on those that know the history, that that date coincides with the moratorium that we just talked about in the last segment, two
right.
years later.
Right.
They decided to target Catalina Island as a quote-unquote takeover destination. But, you know, there were only 25 or 30 of these individuals, you know, who went to the island, and they went to the highest peak on the island, and they essentially did a sit-in. And they used it as an opportunity, essentially a media opportunity, to make the points that they wanted to convey about what they felt were violations of the informing law that created the state of California as a part of the United States.
Right, but let me interrupt, because from the story that I read, it was well planned, meaning they hid guns in their clothes. They dressed like they were going to some kind of conference. They kind of blended in as tourists. And then once they got to Avalon, that's when they brought out their guns and went up into the hills.
Correct, yeah. But again, I would say, and you know, scholars that know better may correct me, but it was not with an intent to inflict or to exercise violence. They didn't, really kind of shoot at anybody. They didn't, do anything that was necessarily violent, but they went up there to make a point, and they carried their guns with them to make that point. And the point essentially was that the informing law that created the state of California and most of the southwestern states was a product of the U.S.-Mexico War that ended in 1848. And at that time, Mexico ceded those lands to the United States on certain conditions in the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. But according to the Brown Berets, in their reading of the treaty, islands off the coast in the Pacific were not included in the landmass that was ceded from Mexico to the United States, and therefore the Brown Berets got in their head that what they wanted to do was to go and quote-unquote reclaim that land and create the notion of a new nation, Aztlan, which is a kind of a mythic notion of a Chicano homeland. And they used the opportunity, I think, to express, elements of their core platform and agenda. And, this is something that has been done in other contexts as well. If you look at the occupation of Alcatraz by Native American activists, even predating the Brown Berets takeover at Santa Catalina Island, they too kind of had a very similar instinct. Sadly, in 1973, the activists at Wounded Knee actually engaged in direct fire with federal authorities, and that ended poorly. Some people were killed.
Yeah.
But there were a lot of actions in the 1970s, 1960s that kind of rolled in that direction. Attica, look at the prisons at Attica Prison in New York. They had a major hunger strike there. There were a lot of efforts on the part of people who were disgruntled at that time to use the stage that the media presented to them to make their statement and their point.
Right. And how were the Brown Berets regarded by the people of Avalon? Were they taken seriously?
Well, I think that the officialdom did kind of claim that they were involved in an invasion, and they took it pretty seriously enough at least to make the claim that they felt threatened. But I think that, most people didn't probably even know what was happening, or if they did, it was probably not taken as a direct or serious threat. It was probably more likely seen as something that it was, which is really just a political statement. And, even today, Dave, in fairness, again, no one wants to promote or encourage any kind of violence or, unnecessary provocation. But, you have militia groups and patriot groups up in the, Northwest in Idaho. The Bundy family has been renowned over recent years. They took over the Milieu National Wildlife Refuge for some number of days back in 2014 or 2015, I believe. They had their points to make. They've been in and out of court really since the late 90s on land rights and their sense of federal government encroachment. So there's neither nothing new nor nothing old about this kind of aspect of Americans from various walks of life and with really diverse political points of view making their points and using the media and the opportunity to bring others along as they see fit with their point of view.
As I recall, after 3-4 weeks, it was a judge. Somebody walked into their encampment and basically said, "You guys got to leave," and they left.
Yeah, time's up. Exactly. Yeah, they knew when the party was over, and lights out, point made, and they moved on. And again, I think these are things that, again, a lot of people might be rattled by it or put off by it, but as long as there's no violence and as long as life is preserved, we have to remember we live in the United States of America, and one of the great principles of our founding, from day one, has been free expression and the First Amendment, the right to to protest and to challenge authority, and that these are all examples that we've just talked about of people exercising that right.
I wonder if you see what I do in the parallels between 1968, 1969, and today. I feel like I'm living my youth all over again.
Don't you? I can go there with you in a second. I mean, I do feel like there is history repeating itself as we watch what's unfolding in our streets. Feels a lot like 1968 to me. Just constant, you know, barrages of, you know, mostly bad news and a lot of stress and, you know, contested points of view, people getting out in the streets, and we're in a dangerous passage. There's no question. I think that, you know, the only thing that gives me solace is remembering that things got even worse, I think, at that time in 1968. We found a way through that somehow, and we were, you know, damaged goods as a result, no question. But some later good things came out of our experience in those times, and I'm hopeful, very hopeful indeed, that this chapter will end in a similar way. We will have to kind of, you know, rip the Band-Aid off the wound to get there, but I'm very hopeful that on the other side of this, we're going to find new ways to find common cause and to reestablish our identity as one nation under God, indivisible with liberty and justice for all.
Should we remind the folks where they find studios on the park?
1130 Pine Street in downtown Paso Robles, right across the street from the downtown park. You really can't miss it. The signage is all there. It's a former auto parts dealership that most people know for many, many decades. And we welcome you to come. Bring your families, enjoy the art, enjoy the evening out on the town. There's much to offer both at studios and in the surrounding community.
The exhibit is called Counter Narrative, an examination of recently discovered Chicano photography from 1980 through the present. It runs until the end of the month. Henry A.J. Ramos, we appreciate your time as always. People can find out more information on the website at studiosonthepark.org. You get 45 seconds for a final thought, sir.
Well, I just want to thank you again for the opportunity to introduce this really interesting content to your listening audience. I hope they'll go check it out and, you know, maybe learn some things that might surprise them and provoke them. I also want to remind folks that we have extended our existing show, The Shape of Human Expression, which is a marvelous survey of the best of Central Coast sculpture and pottery curated by Tom Peck. And go enjoy yourselves. Be safe. Wear your mask. Socially distance. But enjoy what we have to offer. We can't thank you enough for your support.
All right, Henry A.J. Ramos, we appreciate your time. Thank you.
Back at you, Dave.
All right, Henry A.J. Ramos getting us off to a great start here on Hometown Radio. Let's break away, find out what's happening with ABC News. Craig updates us on time saver traffic and weather together. Let's talk about public attitudes towards police. We're live, we're local. This is Hometown Radio.